Hello, and welcome to the World Extreme Medicine podcast. I'm your host for today, Dr. Fionn Davis, expedition doctor and emergency medicine doctor. So, we're diving back into part two of the Everest 2023 Season of Death podcast and my conversation with Dr. Ben Alba, who was one of the base camp doctors for a team ascending Everest this year. We'd already had a fascinating conversation about the trek up to Everest Base Camp and some of the challenges and presentations that he'd already experienced as the medic at Base Camp. But as the title suggests, that this was a really challenging season on Everest this year, with the highest number of deaths that weren't attributable to a natural disaster on the mountain. And Ben, unfortunately, was involved in some of these deaths and his experiences. He shares with us his reflections on some of the issues on Everest and some of the major challenges for the mountain as it becomes more and more commercialized and accessible to climbers. So we're going to dive back into the episode. Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine podcast, Everest 2023, the season of death. It's called the season of death on Everest. So, and you kind of mentioned that you'd unfortunately been involved in some of the deaths on Everest. And what was some of your involvement in that?
So I was involved at a very late stage with a client. So our team summited quite late in the season. So I think we were like the third last team to summit. There was only one team, which was our sister team, the guys who were like next to us, who I'd helped out a little bit, who were going after us. And essentially, I don't know what I was doing. I was just sat around, I think, reading my book, and their Sirdar, who's like their base camp manager, who's Sherpa, ran over to me with a radio and was like, "Need to talk to the boss of his team." And I was like, "Oh, why?" And then he was like, "Just speak to him." So I spoke to him for about 5 minutes, and this chap had been really breathless for a couple of days. They'd been at Camp 4 for a few days, acclimatizing. He tried to summit Everest and had to go back to the tent. And then that day they tried to summit Lhotse, but he'd failed. And they were wondering what to do with him, basically. And it sounded very much like he had hape, and he'd had hape for a little while, possibly a couple of days. So I just got them to give him basically everything. Just inject Stex, give him nifedipine, put the oxygen as hard as you can, just descend as fast as you can. So they did that. And then about, it must have been half an hour later, he came running back. And he was like, "You need to speak to him again." So I spoke to him again. He said, "Oh, he's collapsed." And I was like, "All right. Has he got a pulse?" He said, "No." So I said, "Okay, we'll start CPR." So they started CPR while I got a story about what had been going on, like a better story. So there were four of them up there. Three of them were doing the CPR and running the resus. I was speaking to the boss, and yeah, I ran to the guy's tent to find out his medical history and stuff because the guys in the mountain didn't know. Find out what drugs he was on. Asked them to inject adrenaline if they had any, and then just said like, basically ran through how futile it was. So they were at 7,400 meters, something like that, 7,600 meters. There was no helicopter coming because it was cloudy. It was about to get dark, so it was like 4:30 p.m. There were four of them there. They had no shelter. So I basically said, "Do CPR for 10 minutes. See if check his pulse at 5. Check his pulse at 10, and then we'll talk about it at 10." So we went through the history again. I said, "I think we should end the CPR because it's futile and you're going to put yourselves at risk. So please descend as fast as you can and safely as you can." And the next day, they went and picked up the body, and then he was flown home a couple of days later, having been cremated in Nepal. So I think the outcome for everyone was good. I think the situation could possibly have been avoided, which is, I guess, what we're going to talk about a little bit more in a minute, because I think a lot of the situations that the deaths have been caused by could probably have been avoided this year.
Which is the most tragic part of it, really, isn't it? Is that it is, preventable and avoidable.
Yeah, and as we know, altitude sickness is preventable and avoidable. So why are people dying of it? I don't know.
And it must have been a really tough call for you as a doctor to be thinking about stopping CPR.
Actually,
What was no? Well,
I
there's a
don't
lot of
know.
argument about whether we should start it in the first place in these situations, and I sort of was going to kind of try and ask you a little bit about that. Was that kind of more for his
Well,
colleagues
for
or
this, I actually pulled this up from so the medical provision for wilderness medicine guideline, which was at the back of my head when I was doing this thing. I couldn't remember how many minutes it was of CPR, but for me, 10 was enough because essentially this guy had hape and like there was nothing that was going to save him unless he got like a, well, freeze-mine effusion, CPAP, like the stuff that we had out there essentially. he needed tubing and going to an intensive care unit, essentially. But this is the provision, medical provision for wilderness medicine says, these circumstances permit the termination of CPR on a patient with unwitnessed loss of consciousness and vital signs in the wilderness. No return of spontaneous circulation during 20 minutes. So I did 10, to be fair, 10 minutes short, but there we are. No special circumstance, see below, which is basically hypothermia, lightning strike, submersion, or drowning. Or when a professional medical support is available, either that no shock is advised by an automated defibrillator at any time, or that asystole is observed on an electrocardiogram. So obviously we didn't have a defibrillator, we didn't have an ECG, so that's ruled out. None of the situations that were fitting extenuating circumstances carrying on, and then essentially no response, but spontaneous circulation during 20 minutes. So that was the one I basically based it on. And without a doubt, my main thoughts were about the four guys who were still alive, because it was already cold. It was already dark. There was no way they were getting a rescue. If they're going to do CPR on this guy, they were doing it all night, and they would likely probably die at the same time. So it was kind of a no-brainer, really. It didn't really take me long to decide that, like, they should stop. But it was very upsetting.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, yeah, trying to talk somebody through that through a radio is, yeah, and they're,
yeah,
it's their friend, and, yeah, they're probably keen to help and everything. It's a tough situation, isn't it?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And like you said, it's just so tragic that most of these situations were preventable if it's sort of altitude related. So with that, maybe what sort of elements broadly do you think could be done better or could be preventable with a bit of reflection?
I don't think just that case. I think just all cases is that I'm not sure what. Well, I think the conundrum here is, I know a little bit about the story about this guy, and I've seen clients there, and they're very driven to succeed. You know, that's, they paid however much money it is, like whether it's $25,000, $250,000, anywhere in between. It can be anywhere in between. They've paid that money, and they expect to get to the top. That's basically the expectation. You know, they are expected to get to the top of that mountain. And some people don't listen to their bodies. Some people won't listen to people who are giving them advice. You know, they are going to get to the top of the money, that mountain, regardless of what happens. And I think that is one issue that I don't know how you address that. I really don't. Because you can tell someone anything, and if they're going to say no, then that's it. They have a right to make a poor decision, as we know in medical healthcare, or they have a right to make a decision that we don't feel is what is the best decision. You know, everyone's entitled to their opinion. And then I think the second thing is about just education and learning about your body at altitude. And I think the other sad reality is that a lot of these people who go to Everest haven't been to altitude, so they don't know how their body's going to respond. And I think that's also a problem. And I think one way of addressing that is to, I don't say it's the right thing, but to kind of put in a stepwise, have you ascended to 6,000 meters before, 7,000 meters before, done at peak, now you come to Everest, you know. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable and sensible way of approaching a mountain. You know, like, I've been to 5,500, 5,700, now 5,900, never been above 6, but the next goal is to go to 6 something, and, you know, and just test. And I've been fine at those altitudes, so just carry on going higher and see how you go. But to jump straight to 8,849 meters is, you know, it's a big step.
Massive.
Up from zero.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, the companies who are taking clients are obviously making money regardless of whether they get them to the summit or not. And the Nepalese government giving out the permits also is making money regardless of whether they get to the summit or not. So there's not really much incentive for either of those groups to put some sort of selection or kind of requirements for summiting Everest. But there will come a point when, you know, the bad publicity from deaths or maybe something else maybe outweighs the.
I think that's another issue, though, is accountability. And that if you look at the social media accounts for, so in my essay right at the bottom are all the deaths and all their teams. And the reason I did that was because people need to be accountable, you know, because I'm not saying it's the same teams that are killing people every time, but you look at the history of it, and it's similar teams that are doing the same things and repeating the same mistakes, you know.
Mm.
And whether that's because they're cheap companies and people want to go cheap and it's the cheap people are going, or people don't understand, I don't know. I don't know why. And yes, people are making money out of it, but again, it's responsibility of the government, it's responsibility of the company to make sure that person's going to be safe and that they're going to climb safely and be able to get off the mountain safely. And who's accountable for that is anyone, it's themselves, you know, but they need to be accountable for it. And that's the problem, is they're not.
And there's nobody really policing things from the sounds of it, you know, whether or not people are doing you know, safe ascent profiles, or I think you mentioned that maybe somebody had got to the summit within 8 days of leaving their home country, which is just crazy. Yeah.
That was pretty crazy. I come back to the policing thing. I guess the only people who are policing it is the companies. So the company I work for, again, highly reputable company, been working in the mountains for 30 years. Mm. And albeit we sent them home, we sent them home at the right stage of the expedition, which is not at the end. It's before that stage, you know. And I think that process is that you come on the trip, they've shown they've done things before, and hopefully this is going to be the next step for them. But you soon realize that it isn't, and you make the decision to say, okay, well, this isn't your day. Like, you paid your money, and yeah, you've tried, but ultimately, we don't think it's safe for you. We don't think it's safe for the team. So it's goodbye, you know. And that's, they're hard decisions to make. You know, I was involved in those conversations, and they're not nice conversations to have. But ultimately, you have to believe in yourself that you've saved that person's life. And for the two people we did that to, I truly believe that we saved their lives and the lives of the rest of the team, because if they'd gone up, it would have been a big problem.
Yeah, and that's another massive factor, is that it's not just the climber, it's the support around that. It's the Sherpa that climbs with them. Exactly. It's the other members of the team who, if they're slowed down, you're at higher risk. You know, it was all that as well, isn't there? So that's a really good way to think of it, actually, though, if you're going to have a tough conversation, that you are saving their life by doing so. Yeah.
And I made that quite clear to one of the people who we sent home. And I don't think they understand that, but I hope in time they will.
Maybe one day, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, and like you said, unless the companies kind of take it upon themselves to police these things, then there's probably not really anybody else that's going to do it, no. So aside from the kind of tragic events of the season, you talk a little bit in your essay about the use of medications and drugs in mountaineering to get people to the top, essentially. Do you want to just maybe talk a little bit about your thoughts or opinions?
Yeah, sure. So I guess the main drugs that we use in mountaineering are Diamox, acetazolamide, which I've taken. Fairly safe drug, helps with your acclimatization. Taken it on Kili, I've taken it at Everest. I don't have any problems with it.
Get mad tingles.
You get mad
tingles. You've got really bad tingles,
yeah. Tingles in your hands, feet, sometimes your nose, and then go for a wee every 5 minutes. But other than that, it does its job. And I guess the other two, which are a bit more kind of hardcore, dexamethasone and oxygen being a drug, obviously. Now I guess the dilemma here is that I've used the term doping, and essentially it is doping. You know, we're achieving something that we couldn't achieve without drugs. I guess that's the definition of what doping is, isn't it? Or gaining an advantage by using drugs to do something. I think the reason why it's not really a problem in mountaineering is because mountaineering isn't competitive. So at no point does anyone win any money or win a competition or reach global fame unless you're Conrad Anker, Jimmy Chin, like Nims Dai, you know. Unless you're those people, you're not gaining anything by taking drugs. So the risk is all on you, really. I don't have a problem with using acetazolamide. If you're on a limited time scale, I always take it when I work, because essentially it gives me the best opportunity of performing. If I wasn't working, I probably wouldn't take it, and I'd probably want to see what I'm like without it. Dex is being used as an injectable for people who are, so some people who go with no oxygen, people are using Dex to reduce the risk of kind of haste and HAPE and other kind of sequelae of altitude problems. And again, I don't have a problem with that, but again, you're putting a steroid into your body, and you know, there's always a risk involved with that. And I guess oxygen, the third one, is an interesting one, because people use oxygen from varying heights. So on Everest, on a summit attempt, people can use it from camp 2. Some people left base camp on oxygen and just kind of increased their rate of flow as they increased their height. Some people take it from camp 3. Some people don't use it at all, as we know. So all of these are just giving us an advantage, aren't they? So I think it isn't really an issue at the moment in terms of, like, did you succeed with it? Did you succeed without it? I guess the only people it really matters for are the people who are doing it multiple times and what effect that has on their body. The people like Kenton Cool, you know, like, he's done it 17 times now. Like, if he uses drugs and he's done it 17 times, like, what's the impact of that? Was he like, is he so acclimatized now and he's done it so many times he can just do it without? I don't know. So I don't know. It's interesting. And again, I don't think there's a problem with it in terms of kind of gaining advantage, because what advantage are you really gaining? It's all on you getting to the top of Everest, and if you believe you've done it with drugs or not without drugs, then who cares, you know? So yeah, I guess that's interesting. The guy who did it in 8 days is an interesting one because he looked positively dead at the top. but I think, I don't know the backstory, but he must have either acclimatized at height before he came, which I don't think was the case because he came from America, so he must have come from work. Or he must have used the hypoxic tent to sleep in overnight, and possibly a hypoxic chamber to train in. And obviously there's a lot of controversy with the hypoxic chambers as to the kind of the value, whether they work or not. Because I think I read you have to be in it for more than 12 hours of the day, so over half the day, to actually gain any benefit. Obviously we don't sleep for 12 hours, so you must be doing extra stuff on top of that. We actually had a guy on our team use a hypoxic tent, and he flew into Namche, which is 3,500 meters, and then quickly ascended to, he went to 6,000 within 4 days. And he said he felt pretty rough, and he had acclimatized to 6,000 on his hypoxic tent.
Does a hypoxic tent actually work?
So you basically, it's a chamber around your bed, and then you depressurize it, and it simulates altitude essentially.
Yeah. And you just kind of pump out the air and just kind of...
Yeah, I think it comes with a box that just like, it regulates the air inside and just creates a pressure that, and then you can just slowly incrementally increase that. So I think you start at like 2.5 and then you go to 3 and then 3.5 and then 4 and then 4.2.
So it's like the opposite of a gamma chamber sort of thing.
Yeah, essentially.
And then is it evidence-based? Is there any...
So the Wilderness Medicine Society have written about it in their treatment for... or in their use for altitude sickness and altitude illness, but they're not convinced that it's good enough at the moment.
Interesting.
I haven't read any papers regarding kind of the pros and cons of it, but from first-hand experience, people have used it. They've kind of had problems with it. Some have found it useful, some have found it not useful. So I don't know.
And then in terms of the medications, what was your sense of how many people were taking acetazolamide or dexamethasone on the mountain to actually get to the top?
Yeah, so in our team of 10, I think 8 of them were on Diamox,
mm-hmm.
so acetazolamide, which is fairly standard. And then in terms of dex, no one in our team is on dex.
I think the guidelines is that it's only if you've got HACE or HAPE that you actually give dex. It's not kind of a preventative. It's not recommended for preventative.
It's not recommended as preventative, but you're treating the issue before it happens, I guess.
Yeah.
Where I heard that from is, so my boss, who's climbed Everest 5 times, has been in tents where there have been multiple vials of dexamethasone from people who've just used his tent and empty syringes and needles who are all on no oxygen. And I think it's known to be prevalent in the no oxygen climbing community as something to take in case to both risk reduce the risk of a problem, basically.
And sharp safety sounds like an issue if they're just kind of lying around on the tent that you're about to collapse into.
I found a sharp in base camp just under a rock. So yeah. Sharp safety isn't prevalent up there.
Yeah, not well known. okay, and then I mean, I was going to ask you whether or not, you know, have you really climbed the mountain if you use drugs to do it? But I think
that's on you.
I think, yeah, you've already kind of answered that.
I think I wrote in the essay, achievement is graded by oneself internally. Only the climber can know if they've succeeded in their aim. And I honestly believe that, no one cares. If you want to climb Everest and you want to do it with drugs, be my guest.
Yeah. Like you said, it's not a competition, yeah. Is it? Okay, so then
I guess the question to go back to you then is when it becomes a competition. So, for example, 14 peaks, yeah. And doing the 14 peaks in a record time. Does it matter then?
Well, there was already this debate about was it Reinhold Messner who climbed Everest without oxygen, and then sort of I think he subsequently I might be getting this wrong, but I think he subsequently said that anybody who hadn't done it without oxygen, you know, hadn't really matched his record. So
he would say that, wouldn't he? Given the fact he set the record, but yeah, no,
yeah. I mean, that's the privilege you get when you set the record without oxygen.
Yeah. But it's an interesting point, isn't it? Because it's and what about oxygen starting height? You started oxygen, you could just walk around the whole of the pool with oxygen. Does that matter?
I think it promotes really kind of unhealthy attitudes towards climbing because it kind of gives you the impression that you can ascend quicker and potentially a little bit more unsafer in terms of acclimatization and all of that, because the drugs are going to help prevent mountain sickness, which is not necessarily true, because although we know that acetazolamide helps with sort of prevention, that's not an excuse to ascend like 4,000 meters in a day. you're still going to get unwell if you do an unsafe ascent profile. So I think that the attitude it might promote, if everybody kind of thinks that it's okay to kind of just make your way up the mountain, might be a little bit unhealthy. Okay, so what about some of the, like, we're kind of getting into it already, like the politics of the mountain. So you mentioned about sharps at base camp. I think you picked up an incredible amount of litter at base camp as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I picked up 5 kilos in half an hour of litter, which is a shame. Base camp litter isn't actually that much. That was mainly at the rock, which is where you kind of get into base camp from. And I think that's mainly just tourist traffic, you know. People coming to the rock and dropping bottles and things. And yeah, I mean, it's not right, but base camp itself is very, very clean. Because there is regulation, you know. So the SBCC, which is the Sagarmatha, which is the other name for Everest in Nepali, Sagarmatha Pollution Control Committee, they basically run the bins, essentially, at base camp. So they require every Sherpa to carry down 8 kilos off the mountain on every trip they do, and to drop it off with them. And they also require each company to pay their waste off the mountain, essentially. And that could be anywhere between kind of $3,000 to $10,000 worth of waste kind of paid to get off the mountain, which is carried down. And then there's also a good little recycling center in Namche, which is all the trekkers can, they can carry out a bag of plastics. It just weighs a kilo, so you can just like pick up 5 and walk out with it, which is really cool. And it just helps to get it off the mountain instead of using helicopters and stuff. So albeit I did pick up 5 kilograms at base camp rock, base camp itself is very clean. The issue is the historical waste that there's been. So a lot, obviously in the past, it's not been regulated. So people have dumped tents, gas bottles, sleep bags, waste, food, human waste into crevasses, and it's all kind of been iced over, but unfortunately it's beginning to thaw. So it's actually coming out of the ice now. And then also at camp 4, there's a huge amount of litter and waste, which is just years and years of waste that's just been left there, and it actually looks like a garbage heap, like a trash heap. It's pretty awful, and to think that that's 8,000 meters on a mountain is quite sad.
It's such a shame, isn't it? It really is.
The other issue is to do with, so there is a team that goes there every year. The Nepali military go there to clean up every year, and whether they do that job effectively is for debate. Most of the time they end up climbing the mountain. And there is some rumor that actually some Sherpa are carrying their loads down for them, which is a shame. So I think the effectiveness of the litter control on the mountain itself could probably be better. But the problem is that it's split between the military and the SBCC. So there's friction there in terms of funding and wages received and desires. So I think that's a problem.
And no one organization that's accountable because it's split. Exactly. Yeah. And so what measures do you think could be taken to improve things?
I just think attitudes need to change, you know. I think littering anywhere isn't acceptable. And I think, again, it's a cultural thing, you know. Like, we live in a one-use, one-throwaway kind of life now, don't we? And that's what you see in the litter. The litter's all plastic bottles, Coke bottles, crisp wrappers, chocolate bar wrappers, that kind of stuff. You know, it's all very easy. You know, you carry 10 bars up, you carry 10 bits of plastic down. Like, it's not hard. You know,
And you bothered to carry it up. You know, you took the weight up there. You know, it's actually, if you've eaten the chocolate bar, it's now lighter, so you can carry it down.
For the small stuff, I think that's the way to go about it. Unfortunately, for the bigger stuff, it costs money to get stuff off mountains, and you have to pay Sherpa to carry stuff down, and unfortunately, some teams don't make that margin, or they don't charge enough to make that margin for that to be possible. So they cut a corner and they just chuck it on the floor.
So unfortunate. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world and most incredible mountains, and it's getting ruined slowly by people not doing their bit. Yeah. I guess, like, as medics though, we've kind of got a role within our teams to promote a little bit of sustainability, good good camp hygiene as well, I guess, you know, sharp safety, you know, pick up the looking, well, maybe not their job, but, you know, the kind of awareness within a team that, that, you know, dropping litter is not acceptable. And yes. If you make that the case, then hopefully things will improve, you know, bit by bit, team by team. Yeah. But yeah, like you said, the overall sort of organizational governance of it all probably could be a little bit better as well.
I think you're right. I think the governance is the key thing, and they're still working that out. You know, I think Nepal have a great opportunity to do really well by this mountain, but they just need to work it out. And I think the internal politics that I'm not obviously savvy on need to be kind of fiddled out and worked out. And I think that's where they need to kind of focus on.
And we sort of forget that Everest has only really been like a destination mountaineering mountain for sort of 60 years, 70 years, something like that. So it's fairly recent. You know, it's still not surprising that they're still figuring stuff out.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that, and I guess where this whole, all these issues really resort from is this isn't really mountaineering anymore. This is commercial mountaineering, you know. Even in the 70s and 80s, it was still people who were peak climbers, like alpinists and kind of incredible climbers climbing Everest. And now we're moving into an age where there aren't any incredible climbers climbing Everest. They're all you and me and people on down the street and your neighbours and things. And that's I think that's bringing problems to the area. Obviously, it's great for these people to be able to do that. If you're fit enough and strong enough and you understand the risks and you have trained and practiced and you deserve to go. But I think it also brings an issue of the people who shouldn't be there. And again, there's no regulation of that either, as we've discussed already. So.
No. So one of the other sort of political issues you mentioned, it's not really a political issue, but it's just an issue, isn't it? That maybe if there are some teams that are not as well resourced or you know, a bit more on the cheaper side of things, then this may result to critical equipment not being available or not being purchased.
Yeah.
And then unfortunately that leads to theft, which I was actually shocked to read about in your essay, that theft is a problem on Everest. You just think everybody's there, they're in the same sort of community of climbers and they're all going to help each other out and, you know, look after each other and all this, and that's really not the case from what it sounds like.
Yeah, well, again, I think that community of climbers again is there to some degree, but again it's been lost because of that well, it's just essentially that drive to just succeed yourself, and regardless of what the consequences are, regardless of who's in your way, you know, I think that's what's become of it. And there was unfortunately some theft this year. Our team had some oxygen, some gas canisters, some cooking equipment stolen. So there's actually some teams keep storage up on Camp 4, so a place where they leave stuff for next year essentially. And we'd found that ours had been broken into and stuff had been taken. And you have no way of knowing who did that, because obviously there's no one, there's no cameras, there's no one still up there watching the box. So that's, yes, yeah, sad to hear. But again, like you say, it's because some teams are unfortunately unprepared, or because they haven't put the effort into kind of preparing for the people, the number they've got. So there was a team with 80 people this year, and I fully believe that they weren't prepared for 80 people to summit, and they were expecting people to kind of fall out and to stop before the final push, because they didn't have enough oxygen for people. And yeah, so it's really tricky. Wow. And it's tricky when you can go online, you know, and you're scrounging around on the internet for the cheapest price to go and climb. And I think that's really not the way to do it. You know, you pay a premium because you're paying for a service, you're paying for support and experience in the guides and experience in the Sherpa and things. And if you're just going to pay $20,000 to go up Everest, then and click and buy it online, I think that's the wrong way to go about it.
Yeah, and safety. You're paying for your own safety.
I think what epitomizes the lack of camaraderie between people actually is that story about that chap who was rescued. I don't know if you saw it, the guy was carried off in a foam wrapper.
Yeah.
So he was carried from 8,000 meters down to 7 or something, and then had the audacity to not even thank the Sherpa. He thanked the company that had left him behind and his sponsors. Which is outrageous.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, yeah, and I have heard those stories of companies who are maybe a little bit on the cheaper side of things, And they have to find a way to make it cheaper. So there are things that are cut corners on, or that are maybe not as well resourced or prepared for that other companies may be. So yeah, you've got a question. And if you're doing this as a once in a lifetime trip, which for most people it is, this is like the biggest thing they're ever going to do. Why would you do it on the cheap? If you're doing it because this is going to be the pinnacle of your, mountaineering experience, then,
I think,
adequately resource it.
yeah, but I think it's a lack of insight again. Like I can speak like I speak because I've been there and I've lived there, and I even had a discussion with a Guardian reporter who wrote an article about the deaths in Everest this year being accountable to climate change, which is just wrong. Like it's just plain wrong. Like three of the deaths were because of an ice collapse, which okay, arguably could be due to climate change, but they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time and they died. That's really, really sad, but it's just happened some years. Two or three people died because of falls and the rest were all because of altitudes. Now, none of those things I can think of are due to climate change. And I wrote to her to say this, you're using two buzzwords here, using Everest and using climate change. You're just putting them together and essentially you're creating clickbait. And she said, well, it was a government official said that. And I said, well, I don't really care if a government official has said it because it's not true. So you have to look into the facts, and I'm very privileged to have lived there for 2 months and been able to dig deeper into these issues. But the other issue is that people are commenting from afar about this place that is in a valley in the middle of a country that's one of the poorest countries in the world, in the middle of nowhere, that's only accessible by helicopter. People aren't going there to go and find out about it. The only people who are experiencing the people are living there. I think that's a really big problem in the media, and is why these people are just signing on to trips, because they read, oh, these guys have got oxygen and they'll look after me and things. And to research this kind of thing is quite intensive and takes a lot of time. But again, you can just book onto it online, like buying a dress.
And a lot of it is driven by social media, which I think
Yeah, 100%.
you kind of touch on later on in your essay. But it's people commenting from afar, but maybe it's somebody who's posted a picture of, say, Nims posted the picture of the big queues for the summit on Everest, became a massive news article, became a massive story. So you get a lot of opinions and a lot of sort of outside influence on via social media.
Yeah, that's very true. And I and the limbs thing is interesting because that photo was, well, the reason why that photo was so popular was obviously because of the queue that was there. But what wasn't addressed in that was the reason why that photo occurred. So the reason why there were so many people on that day going up that climb is because that year there were so few weather windows. So this year could have been very much the same, but thankfully we had like maybe 10 weather window days, so there was lots of time for people to go up. And that's not what it's like every year, but people now assume that that is the queue on Everest. That's what it's like at the top. Yeah, our guys went up and there was no one on the, was barely anyone on the queue on the ledge. So yeah, biting into these kind of short segments and these pictures and people saying things is a very short, in a 2 month expedition, that's a 2 second clip, and that's very dangerous, and people, it makes people think it's everything is achievable. And even his slogan, like what, anything possible and stuff, again, you've got to think about how many years these people have been mountaineering for, and how experienced these guys are who like treat Everest as the summit of their entire career. And then you've got these people who go on one mountaineering course and then try and climb Everest. There's a huge disparity between what the people used to climb Everest do and the people now.
And in terms of the social media kind of influence that ha it has over Everest, what do you notice about the attitudes of climbers and towards social media? And I guess how prevalent is it to see people sort of setting up a little selfie stick or filming a little thing on to go on their Instagram or whatever? Is there a lot of that around?
I mean, it's rife, there's people who don't have Instagram, they're just taking photos for the family and stuff, and they're as common as the people who do it for Instagram and things. But I think Instagram is one of the bigger problems, and again, it's a snapshot of your time there. You're displaying often a false picture of what Everest is like, because
Yeah,
it's
showing
hard,
the best, Everest is the best aspects of it, not the tough things or the horrible things. You would
exactly like Everest is like
people put on social media.
Yeah, technically Everest isn't a hard climb. You know, there's not. You don't have to do any like you're not on your hands and feet. You're not like climbing a brick wall. There's no grappling involved. No. Yeah, it's a fixed line up a very steep route at times through very tricky terrain, and what it requires is resilience and power and you know, a determination to get to the top. But the problem is that it's been made to look like it's really easy, for one, which it's not. It's the highest mountain in the world, so it's not easy to do. You know, you've got to be fit, you've got to be active, you've got to be acclimatized, you've got to be good at altitude, you've got to know how to put crampons on, which some people don't. You've got to know how to work with the rope, which some people don't, you know, when they get there. So you've got to know these things. But again, you know, that people get to the top and they have an awful day, and they're having like arguably some of them shouldn't get to the top, and they just put on their social media, "I got to the top." So that's not the full story, is it? That's the problem.
And it's a problem for medics too, because if you get a load of clients turning up thinking this is going to be easy, and that who don't know how to put their crampons on, you're taking on that risk essentially, aren't you, of trying to support them to get to the top?
I think that side of it is very much held by the guides. But we are always in conversation with the guides about like what they're comfortable with and what's going on and how clients are doing and things. But there are some people fail because of the guiding issue. You know, they're not strong enough to be there, regardless of their medical history. Like they're not capable of having the right gear or doing the right things. You know, and that is a different ballgame.
So in your essay, just linking onto that, you mentioned that you've seen people fall apart and not only risk their own lives, but also the lives of the Sherpa around them. Could you expand a little bit on what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that comes back to what we were talking about earlier about the relentlessness that people go to get to the top, regardless of the consequences. And I think, again, that entitlement, understanding of entitlement that these people have, of I've paid this amount of money and I deserve to be at the top, is a problem. Because again, when the discussion that we had with this person to try and get them to turn around, to try and stop, to make them realize, they were 3,000 meters above us on the radio, and they can very easily say no to whatever we suggest because we're not there. You know, you can't physically pick someone up and turn them around. And again, you're at altitude, you're in a place where you've not been before, you're probably not thinking straight, and trying to give advice to these people is really hard. And this person in particular was very, very lucky that they're still alive, because if the weather had come in, if we hadn't suggested to the team that had already descended to go back up and help them, then the outcome could have been very different. But again, coming back to the social media aspect of that, is that people probably won't know that story, and all they'll hear is that they got to the top, but they don't hear about the 16 to 20 hours that they spent on that mountain, like not doing that well. And again, that's the problem, and is why people die again, because they don't listen.
As the medic, when you're having these conversations about, you know, strongly advise people to go down, or you know, if they're going to act against your advice, is there a phrase you use, or is there a bit of paper you get them to sign? Obviously it's not practical if they're already halfway up the mountain, but what do you sort of, or do you document to kind of cover yourself
I'm very bad at handwriting but I document everything we do, and especially those decisions. You know, I think you've got to be very, again, maybe I'm a bit kind of clear in my thought process when I do these things, but I'm very clear in my limit of threshold of what I'm happy with and not happy with. And that I wouldn't say that even comes from experience, because I mean, ED and expedition medicine, two very different things, but I think it's just an understanding of like humanity and humans. And I look at myself and I think, what would I be willing to accept in this situation? Like, I could probably be in the position there, in what would I feel comfortable with? And as soon as I get to that threshold, for me, that's it. I just say, look, this is my advice. This is what I advise you do. Well, within your right to not accept that advice, because you're human, you're compos mentis, so you can make your own decision. But regardless of the consequences, regardless of the money, this is what I advise you to do. And if they say no, then that's fine. I'd have no problems with that, because ultimately they've made a decision. It's their decision to make. And I might not even be right.
I think the problem is that if they say no, but you know that that's then endangering, like, you know, the other three Sherpas that are supporting that person or something, it becomes a difficult issue, doesn't it?
It's true. And this particular person we're talking about, we did have that, not, it wasn't just me that had the conversation. It was four of us all having the conversation with her and with them. And what can you do?
Yeah, that's all you can do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, we've already touched a little bit on the deaths on Everest this year. So the worst year on record without natural disaster, with 17 deaths in total. And you've already kind of broken it down in terms of some were from ice fall, some were from just falls, some were from altitude. What do you think maybe needs to change about the attitude or the approach to Everest to maybe try and avoid this in future seasons?
I think, like we've said, I think it's two things. I think it's awareness, and that awareness not only from the guides and the Sherpa, but also from the people themselves. You know, I think you know when you're unwell, and it's about not pushing through that, and it's about appreciating it. Which, again, there's a lot of things going on in your head here. You're on a 2-month expedition. You've paid all this money, and they're all understandable factors, but ultimately it's your health, you know, and I think people need to be aware of that. But I think the main crux of this and is what needs to be developed in the future is the experience element. And I think there really should be a tiered system to getting to Everest. Like, there's so much focus now on the seven summits. There's so much focus on 14 peaks. There's so much focus on mountaineering in general, people going out and about and in Scotland and things. And these people have no idea what they're doing, you know. The mountains are dangerous places, not only at high altitude, at low altitude, with avalanche risk. You know, there's lots of dangers in the mountains, and people don't understand that. They think that because they see it on TV, they see, like, you know, Alex Honnold freestyling El Cap and stuff, like, oh, I could do that on, you know, my local wall, you know, like, and you don't, again, you don't see the background to that of these guys have been climbing for 40 years. That, like, they started in their vans and they've been driving around Canada for 10 years. And, you know, you see Marc-André Leclerc, like, amazing climber. He died in a mountain. You know, you spend enough time in a dangerous place, you die. Like, and these guys who go having done one course to Everest, like, the risk is high, you know? It's not just you're not just ambling up, like, a little hill. So I think it's an awareness thing of altitude illness. I think it's an experience thing. You have to have those two things and put it together.
Hmm.
I think that's it. It's as simple as that.
I think you've summed that up beautifully. So we've talked a lot about maybe the kind of negative aspects of the season on Everest this year. What were maybe some of the good bits? What were the positive bits that you really enjoyed about the job?
Yeah, I think my biggest positive was again just working with the Sherpa. Like, the reason I went back to Nepal was just because I love it there. The people are great, the culture's great. I'm a real big fan of Buddhism. Like, I think it's a great, like, religion and the spirituality of it, and being able to give something back to them. Like, they do so much for us and me and the team, and just even the smallest thing, like getting these guys with frostbite away and like treating them well and getting them on the insurance and stuff. And that was just like, that felt really good, you know. I felt good about myself doing that, which we don't often get to say, and that was, yeah, just really rewarding. And then I got to meet some amazing people up there, like my boss Guy Cotter, like one of the most
mountaineering legend
in the area, like, and he was there in 1996 with the disaster on Everest. A guy called Joe French, who's just written a book and is a filmmaker, who's written about his experience kind of in the avalanche of 2015 and things, the earthquake. Various Sherpa who've been part of history. Ang Dorji, who was our Sherpa, 22-time summiter, like, incredible man. Like, he's like in his 50s, late 50s, and he's still going up Everest, and he's still probably got 10 years left in him. It's like amazing, amazing stuff. And the history of the area with the avalanches and the disasters that's been there, and the Tukla Hill, at the top of the Tukla Hill, there's this like cemetery and memorial place, and you can just go around and see Rob Fisher, fishes more on things. And yeah, it's just the place is powerful. And getting out of your tent every morning and looking at those mountains was like you could never get bored of it. Like, it was unreal. Like, every morning you're just at the foot of these like huge bits of rock. It's cool. And yeah, just being there was incredible. Like, I don't regret it for a moment. Like, it was such a good time. Thankfully that year as well. So this year was the 70th year since Hillary and Tenzing climbed Everest. So there was a big celebration back in Kathmandu, and I got to see Jamling Norgay, which is Tenzing's son, and Peter Hillary both talk about their dads and the legacy they left behind and stuff. Wow. So that was really cool. We also heard from Sue Leadon, who's the daughter of John Hunt, who actually ran the expedition in 1953 when they summited. And there was also a lady there called Pasang Lamu Sherpa, who's a lady who's like the first, she's the first mountain instructor in Nepal. And she's also summiting K2. And I think she was the first woman to do that as well, which is like incredible that like the local people now are getting involved and the women are becoming guides and things. And that's like really humbling to see. So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff going on, and there's a lot of philanthropy there. The business the company I work for, like, send money to the earthquake victims. So the people who've lost mothers, fathers, brothers and sisters, they put them through school and things. And there's hospitals that have been built there and climbing centers. And that's all really good. Like, there's some good stuff going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's a good place to end, I think, because it can be a little bit kind of serious, and there are some serious issues to talk about on Everest, but you know, it's easy to forget that it is an incredible experience, and like you said, a powerful place to visit.
100%.
Yeah. I am just going to finish by asking you to read out your conclusion, because I could not put it better than you've already written it. So would you mind reading out your conclusion from your essay for us?
Yeah, sure. So the bottom of the essay. So a significant detraction for me of what Everest has become revolves around the relentless and shameless social media updates and posting, but also some fundamental issues with the way the mountain is treated. Beyond no illusion, there is a certain degree of comfort to the majority of an Everest expedition, as well as a significant price tag. And this leads to a sense of entitlement by the clients and an underestimation of the sacrifice required to reach the summit of Everest. When I say sacrifice, I talk of the physical and mental sacrifice, an understanding of the hardship required, opposed to the mindless and selfish human sacrifice from people who have no insight into their own ill health or their own skills, and the time to abort and live for another day. Because that decision not only affects you, but also the team around you. There's no shame in being unsuccessful on Everest. The mountain will always be there, but if you lose your fingers, or your toes, or even your life, you won't be.
Yeah. Great place to finish. And I just want to acknowledge as well that we've already mentioned at the bottom of your essay, you've included a list of all the people that have died on Everest this season, including the teams that they were with, just to acknowledge and to honour them. So thank you so much, Ben. Is there anything you want to add?
Thanks, Ben. No, that's great. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been great. And yeah, we hope to have you back on the podcast sometime soon. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
And best of luck with your move to Cornwall.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical and performance medicine. Thanks again.